The GOP has a problem.
We have to show that we care. That means no more Harriet Myers, no more Brownie, no more Sarah Palin.
Nobody has to hit Republicans over the head. Hey, lose the White House and both houses of Congress, and pow, the GOP is right on the case. 2008 was a bad year for conservatives. Will Obama get the right in America to focus? Making us care. For the GOP, it's the takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning. It's Friday, December 26th. You survived Christmas, John.
I did.
You're
survived,
here in
yes.
one piece.
Indeed. It was a great Christmas. Good morning, Adora.
Good morning, everyone. Today, we're going to take a look at research that says poverty does affect the brain. And now that Christmas is over, we have some advice on the green way to get rid of the Christmas tree and other leftovers from the holidays. Those stories are coming up. But first, these headlines.
Western states are in for a snowy day. Winter storm system is moving across the country. Colorado is in the crosshairs. 20 inches of snow could cover part of the state's west. Winds could reach 80 miles an hour, and they're on the brink of an intensified conflict in the Middle East. On the other side of the world, Palestinian militants in Gaza have stepped up rocket attacks against Israel lately, and Prime Minister Ehud Olmert warns Israel is ready to attack if the militants don't stand down.
I can tell you, we have the power, we have enormous power. We can do things which will be devastating.
The Gaza Strip is primarily controlled by Hamas.
Here in the U.S., there's potentially good news today for shoppers, and that's only because the shopping season was so slow and sellers need to make up some money before year's end. Retailers are offering massive sales around the country, huge markdowns, and all kinds of free shipping deals. This, as new data from the tracking group Spending Pulse shows, total retail sales could be down as much as 8%. Overseas, China is the latest nation to join the fight against pirates off the coast of Somalia. Several Chinese warships are on the way now. Other countries have sent gunboats recently to secure the busy shipping lane. Just yesterday, German forces foiled a hijacking there.
Yesterday, Eartha Kitt, 81 years old, the singer and performer, died. And she was, of course, a legend on Broadway and in movies like Batman, and as well as part of the holiday season. Santa Baby, her big hit in 1953. The Boston Celtics streak is over. The LA Lakers ended it with a Christmas Day win. Lakers guard Kobe Bryant was having a lot of fun.
Yeah, just from the challenge of it. It's a team that's been playing so well. But at the same time, they did win 19 in a row, so they were due for one kind of malaise kind of a game.
And when Kobe says you're due, you're due. Boston fans can keep their heads up. The Celtics still have the best record in the NBA. There's some intriguing NFL action this weekend. We'll get a preview from takeaway gridiron guru Jay Cowett. And we may also tell you why women love touching his hair here around the takeaway studios. In world markets, it was a mixed bag in Asia. I did not know that European markets are closed today for the Christmas holiday. Wall Street had the day off yesterday, but traders get back to work today. And we're talking about streaks.
All kinds of streaks. Political streaks, entertainment streaks. Not smoking streaks, we want to hear.
Streaks.
Yeah, business streaks.
People
not good, though, for business.
Yeah, not
no good.
Good
streaks
not good.
This
right.
year
not,
so
not
far.
877-8 My Take, a story of what streak you particularly followed, you particularly remember, or something personal in your own life. 877-8 My Take or mytake at thetakeaway.org.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at knightfoundation.org. And by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everyone. We want to bring you up to date on a few stories that we are following through this hour. Intelligence officials quoted by the Associated Press say Pakistan is moving thousands of troops from the Afghan to the Indian border. Not many details yet, but that's an important story that we're following. Also, the aftermath of this horrible situation in Covina, California, where a man killed eight people and then himself on Christmas Eve breaking into a party, possibly spawned by a divorce. Also, full holiday weather news and the woes of the retailers. All things that we're following this morning on The Takeaway. And if you're feeling that kind of morning after Christmas feeling, Republicans have been feeling like it's the morning after some horrible party for quite some time now. A number of landmark events this year make it urgent for the conservative movement in the United States and the Republican Party to think about what the future is. And as we mentioned at the top of the program, it's a very significant challenge. Even the death this year of Paul Weyrich, the important founder of the Heritage Foundation, suggests the Republican Party and the conservative movement more broadly are looking for a new vision, or perhaps trying to find the path back to its old vision. Is it time to get back to basics or move forward? David Frum joins us now. He's a resident fellow at the American Enterprise Institute. David, thanks for being part of the program today.
Thank you.
What do you think the urgency is from your perspective as a conservative, as someone who's worked in a number of Republican administrations, to this kind of retooling or revisioning of both the conservative movement and the Republican Party in 2009?
Well, a lot of Republicans and conservatives would say, what's the problem? John McCain got 46% of the vote or maybe 47, depending on how you count, this last election. That's a lot better than Bill Clinton got in 1992. There was a recession on, so, yeah, we took a bump. But, we're well-positioned to do well next time, as happened. You know, we did well in 94 after 92. We did well in 1980 after 1976 and so on. Here, let me just go through what's wrong with that way of thinking, which is, at the moment, the dominant way of thinking on the Republican and conservative side. What's wrong with it is when you look more carefully at who voted for John McCain and who did not, what you see is that Republicans have lost the support of the better-educated voters in America and the younger voters in America. In 1984, Ronald Reagan won 20-somethings by 20 points, and he won first-time voters by 21 points. Barack Obama won those same two categories of young people by even bigger margins this time. No Republican has won in the under-30 vote since 1988.
Wow.
Republicans used to rack up big totals among the college-educated. Among whites with college degrees, the elder George Bush beat Michael Dukakis by 20 points in 1988. Today, Barack Obama won the college-educated. And while John McCain won whites with college degrees, he did so very, very narrowly by I think, 2 points. And this at a time when the number of whites with college degrees is growing. As recently as 1990, only 20% of white Americans had a college degree. Today it's almost 30%.
Well, that's a devastating indictment of the, hey, wouldn't it be great to have a beer with George W. Bush strategy of attempting to identify the electorate with your candidate if the educated electorate is retreating from the GOP.
The GOP has been winning bigger and bigger shares of a dwindling demographic.
Hmm.
What happened in the Reagan years is Ronald Reagan made this great breakthrough into a part of the country that had once been the base of the Democratic Party, the white working class. That is, whites who are not poor, but who didn't have a college degree. And that created the conservative majorities of the 1980s and early 1990s. The problem is that group of people is shrinking relative to the rest of the country because the country is becoming less white, and the white part of the country is becoming better educated and less working class.
And David,
so the future looks a little ominous for this approach.
But isn't that then reflective of the dissatisfaction that many Americans have with what the Republican Party, the conservative movement, has come to represent? I mean, let's look at this legacy of President Bush, two wars and a terrible economy.
As President Bush himself said, he said, this is not a presidency where you wave your hand and ride off into the sunset. No, it's been a very traumatic time with a lot of bad news. But there's been a lot of good news, too. A very long expansion, a lot of jobs created. I don't think this is a negative verdict driven exactly by people's reaction to George Bush or recent events, because it starts, you can see these trends all starting in the late 1990s. It has been since the late 1990s or mid-1990s that Republicans have been losing the young and have been losing their traditional franchise among the educated. And it's been since the middle 1990s that their share of the less educated vote among white people has been going up and up and up.
So what do you think explains it?
So we have a deep, long-term secular trend.
So what do you think explains that?
What do I think explains it?
Yeah, why is that? Why is this trending in that direction?
there are a lot of very complicated reasons, but if I were to just pick out one, mm-hmm. I would say what happened in the 1990s was the Democratic Party moved to the center on economics. The Democrats had always had a kind of social democratic smell to them. They'd always been like the British Labour Party since the, you know, for half a century anyway, like the British Labour Party, like Scandinavia. That was what they looked to. And so Americans who were winners in the market system, who had property, who had jobs, who had succeeded in a competitive economy, looked at the Democrats as a danger and a threat. Well, in the 1990s, the Democrats moved away from that social democratic tendency, and they made themselves more acceptable to Americans who were successful in the market system at a time when the market system was winning all the arguments.
Well,
and that meant the argument between the parties tended to focus on cultural issues, and there Republicans represented a shrinking part of the country, and Democrats spoke to a growing part of the country.
I guess what troubles me about that argument, David, is that you're talking about Democratic failures and sort of broad demographic shifts that don't appear to be favoring the Republicans in this decade. Yet, maybe there's this really simple way of looking at it. What happened was the Republicans had an opportunity after 9/11 to basically change the relationship between the United States and the rest of the world, and didn't, and the setback was devastating. And the Republicans had the opportunity after the Clinton surplus to basically extend in an extraordinary way the expansion, and indeed instead lost it in a way that's historical going back to the 1930s. You don't have to go much beyond those two gigantic setbacks to understand where the GOP is at this point.
I'm not sure I would agree with your characterization of those two events, but it doesn't matter because they don't make sense of the chronology. This decline of support for the Republicans,
it's really not about chronology, it's about perception. And that's the issue, and that's where the Republicans have to live. What's the message that's going to reverse that perception?
The decline of support for the Republicans among the young starts not in 2002 or not 1999 with the surpluses. It starts in the year 1990. The decline for Republicans among the college-educated starts about 1990.
But doesn't it get cumulative at some point, though? And I guess the question is, what do you think is going to turn the boat around today, or what can the conservative movement, the GOP, do in 2009, you think, to address some of those declines?
Well, that's a very good question. I would suggest, I've written a book about this, and I'm launching a new website about this, so this is going to be a big theme of my future work. I think there are really four things that Republicans need to begin to do. This is going to be, we didn't get into the trouble quickly, we won't get out quickly, but we need to focus on those people we have lost, and we need to reconnect with younger America. And so I would propose this formula. One, we need a more relevant economic message. The message of tax reductions, which was very important in the 1970s and 1980s when the personal income tax had really gotten out of line for a large numbers of people. We're not going to abandon that message. We remain a party of low taxes, but that's not where the pressure on middle incomes is coming from today. It's coming from the problem of rising health care costs. We need to have an economic message that has that puts health care and health care reform where taxes used to be. We need an environmental message, not because the environment is the issue for very many people, but because for millions of people, you're not even acceptable unless you have an environmental message. It's the way national security was in the 50s and 60s. You can't play politics unless you're sound on national security. That's going to be the case for the environment of the future. We need a more modulated social message, not to cease to be a conservative party, not to cease to be a majority pro-life party, but so there's room for people for whom that issue is less important. It has to be possible for us to have a pro-choice running mate, even if the head of the ticket is usually pro-life. It can't be that no one who has a pro-choice view is ever allowed on a Republican ticket ever again, and that we favor a human life amendment that would ban abortion across the country for everybody, and where we seem to be talking about gay rights or against gay rights all the time. Americans, you know, are non-discriminatory people.
And number
we
four?
Have to have, and number four, we have to have an ethic of competence in government. We want smaller government, but we have to stop pretending we're going to make the government go away. We're not going to make it go away, and that part of it that still is there has to work better, and we have to show that we care. That means no more Harriet Myers, no more Brownie, no more Sarah Palin.
All right. Well, that's a full plate for any website launch or a book. David Frum, his forthcoming book will be called The New Majority. And when do you launch the website?
Sorry, the website is called newmajority.com. The book has been out for a year, and it's called Come Back, Conservatism That Can Win Again.
Thanks, David. David Frum joined us from the American Enterprise Institute in Washington, D.C., where he is a resident fellow.
can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual, dedicated to helping safeguard businesses and employees through comprehensive insurance products and services. More information at libertymutualgroup.com. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. Well, we're asking you about your favorite streaks, sports streaks or otherwise. The Celtics lost their career record streak last night to the Lakers. Their 19-1 record
must have been
stay in the books.
Disappointing.
Yeah, Kobe Bryant kind of stomped them out there in L.A. But what's your favorite streak?
Yeah, hi. This is Bill from Hawthorne, New Jersey. And I think the penultimate streak in sports was Joe DiMaggio's hitting streak. Where at the end of that 54-game hitting streak, he missed one game and then went on and ripped off another long streak.
In fact, that is called the streak, DiMaggio streak. Fabulous.
Thank you, John.
877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. We're going to continue our discussion of sports, beginning with the Celtics, with our own Jay Cowett, who is the person on this show, I think it's fair to say, who tracks sports for us. He's sort of a cross between a Uber expert and an Uber fan, I think. He's also our broadcast engineer here on the program. Jay, thanks for joining us.
Hey, no problem. It's a dirty job, but someone's got to do it.
Someone's got to do it. What's your favorite streak?
My favorite streak, well, you know, our caller just mentioned the DiMaggio streak, which has all the...
That's the famous
You
one,
know,
yeah.
the hullabaloo about
right.
it. But Johnny Vandermeer, who played for the Cincinnati Reds in the first half of the last century, had two straight no-hitters in 1938.
Oh,
and to me, that's the most impossible streak to break. Out of anyone. It's also the
right.
shortest. It's only
shortest,
two, which
right,
makes
right,
it
right.
kind of poetic.
But but anyone who knows anything about baseball knows two no-hitter. One no-hitter is amazing enough, but two in a row is a mind-blower.
And
a
to
jaw-dropper.
Break it, someone would have to pitch
right.
three in a row,
right.
which is almost impossible.
Right. And nobody pitches three games in a row anyway anymore. It even makes it to the sixth inning anymore. Well, let's talk basketball. What do you think the significance is of this Lakers-Celtics game yesterday, which seemed like a replay of the NBA Finals and all of a sudden made it look, even though the Celtics seemed unstoppable, like, wow, we could have a really interesting playoffs this year?
Oh, I think it makes it great. You know, you had the Lakers-Celtics last year, and the thing that makes great rivals is carrying it over. It's not just having one year where they're up against each other. It's having multiple years or a couple years in a row where they carry this over and they carry this anger and hate over. And you could tell last night the Lakers wanted this. The Lakers wanted revenge. You could see Paul Gasol, who had a rough finals last year against the Celtics, came out and went 3-for-3 from the floor in the final quarter, 3-for-3 from the free throw line, was banging his chest.
Mm.
You could tell they're into this. It's good for tepid NBA fans. You want to see
right.
these two teams as your rivals. You want to see the Celtics. You want to see the Lakers. And you want to see it be competitive. Because, quite frankly, the finals last year, you know, the Celtics
yeah.
ran over them.
Celtics just stomped. And what did Kobe say last night? He said it was time. They were due to have a malaise kind of game.
I'm interested in that, too. When you have a team like the Celtics who won so many in a row, who have the best start in NBA history at 27-3 now, does one loss throw them off the tracks a little bit because they're so not used to it happening?
Well, it's early. I mean, people like to say the NBA has two seasons. There's the regular season and there's the playoffs, which go endlessly. But there was more basketball this holiday weekend than there's been in decades. I mean, they really concentrated a lot of games both yesterday on Christmas and all through the weekend.
Well, I think they see it as kind of their window to really pick up a whole bunch of fan base that they're losing to the NFL right now. You know, NFL has Thanksgiving, and they've made that a three-game day. And now with the NBA, they have an opportunity where there's not baseball going on, where football's nearing the end of the season, where nobody watches hockey anyway. So they have an opportunity to really get out there and show what they're about, and they put their best game probably of the regular season on the day.
All right, well, let's shift over to the NFL because a lot of people are going to be paying attention. The huge sports headlines are NFL this weekend, and a lot of the diehard fans of teams like the Jets and the Baltimore Ravens and the Miami Dolphins and the Patriots are going to be doing that complicated complicated end-of-season NFL math, which determines how the heck you get into the playoffs. The Jets have probably the most complicated situation here.
Well, insofar as they have to deal with a lot of emotions to get where they want to be anyway. To get into the playoffs, the Jets have to win and then hope for a New England or Baltimore loss, but they also have to go against their old friend, Chad Pennington, who they let go to Miami in the preseason when they signed Brett Favre. And I saw somebody compare Brett Favre to a Ferrari and Chad Pennington to a Pinto at the beginning of the year, that the Jets threw out the Pinto to take in this Ferrari.
Well, what they're discovering is that the Ferrari was from the 1950s, apparently. That's the problem. Let's hear.
I don't know if that's so fair. Favre has had a very good season, or at least a better season than what many expected. It's 9-6 is respectable.
It's interesting, and he brought the Jets from a 4-win team to now a 9-win team, and he's made the Pro Bowl, but the story behind that is that maybe he doesn't deserve to be there. Chad Pennington, who came from the Jets and went to Miami, has brought a 1-15 team to almost the brink of a division title. And he's also played better ball. He's thrown less interceptions. He's handled a very efficient Miami offense that's only had 13 turnovers all year. Brett Favre has had 6 turnovers himself in the last 4 games.
Well, you can hear it in their voices. Let's play Favre and then Pennington, and you can decide for yourself who's the whiny one and who's the one who's on top of the world at this point.
Exactly.
Whether I walk away today, 3 years ago, I can't look back and say, boy, that's one thing I wanted to do. One play, one season is not going to, it's not going to make a difference.
Now that's Favre.
That's Favre.
Not exactly.
Whiny Favre.
Not exactly the leader you want. And here's Pennington from this week.
Yeah, I'm excited about it. Our whole team's excited about having the chance to be able to have one shot into the playoffs. And that's what you work so hard for the whole season, to get to this point, to have an opportunity to play an extra game.
And the Dolphins win, they're in, right?
Dolphins win, they're in, and they win their division, which would be a record turnaround. They were the worst team in the league last year. They get Barcells in, they get Tony Sperano in from the Cowboys, and they've turned it all around.
And again, just like we were talking about with the NBA, this is a great rivalry. This is what the NFL needs. This is what sports needs right now in this complex, sort of disturbing economic environment. Jay Cowett, thanks so much.
Hey, thanks so much, guys.
Jay Cowett, our broadcast engineer and sports tracker here on The Takeaway. Now, Jay, open Femi's mic. She's got some headlines.
Thank you. He's so multi-skilled. Good morning, Jay. Good morning. Or 28 minutes past the hour. There are reports of tension between two nuclear-armed nations. Thousands of Pakistani troops appear to be on the move to the country's border with India. Tensions are high in the wake of the Mumbai attacks. Actually, today is the anniversary to the month that those attacks happened in Mumbai. And India blames the shootings on Pakistan-based militants. Pakistan and India have gone to war 3 times since independence from the UK in 1947. Tensions also high in the Middle East, where they're bracing for a new round of fighting between Israel and Hamas. Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Olmert warned Gaza militants to halt rocket attacks.
I can tell you, we have the power. We have enormous power. We can do things which will be devastating.
Gaza is primarily controlled by Hamas. And more than a dozen are dead after a riot jailbreak in Iraq. The dead include both security guards and insurgent prisoners. Several insurgents managed to escape in the fighting. Iraqi police say prisoners involved were all suspected Al-Qaeda in Iraq members. And that's your news for now.
Thank you, Femi.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation and its campaign for American workers. More at rockfound.org.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual, dedicated to celebrating personal responsibility and to proving its own with a comprehensive array of auto insurance products. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility, what's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning. Scientists have long suspected that poverty affects children's brains. In recent years, they've begun to use sophisticated imaging tools and other methods to understand exactly how that process works. Professor Martha Farah, director of the Center for Cognitive Neuroscience at the University of Pennsylvania, has just written an article for a scientific journal reviewing recent research on the issues, and she joins us. Welcome, Professor.
Thanks.
So, what did you discover?
Well, we discovered that there is a burgeoning literature just in the last few years. Suddenly, cognitive neuroscientists have discovered socioeconomic status. You know, for most of the history of cognitive neuroscience, we were studying the typical brain, which actually meant the brain of the college sophomore who you could, you know, easily get into the lab and, you know, scan for $20 subject payment. But people are now more interested in how different normal human beings differ from one another. And one important dimension along which people's life experiences differ, and it turns out their brain function differs, is socioeconomic status.
What comes to mind immediately would be malnutrition, for example.
Yeah, people usually assume that the causes of these differences in brain development are physical causes, because the brain is a physical thing, and you'd expect things like nutrition, also exposure to environmental toxins like lead, to account for the differences, because poor kids are less well-nourished, exposed to more lead, and so forth. And certainly those physical factors play a role, but probably the biggest factors are actually psychological.
You want to explain that?
Yeah, sure. Poor kids live in more stressed households, and we are beginning to understand how psychological stress gets transduced, if you will, by the body into physical conditions. Stress affects all different kinds of aspects of your physical health, but also it affects your brain and your mind.
In what ways?
Well, myriad ways. Probably the most relevant in terms of child development is that very young creatures of all kinds, animals and people, don't have their own systems in place at birth for regulating their own stress levels. So when a baby is upset and distressed, it's the human mother or the mama rat who soothes the human baby or the rat pup. And that process enables the young creature's own stress regulation systems to continue developing normally and to eventually sort of take over from the mother.
I'm wondering, when you image the brain, where do you see much of this activity taking place based on the current research?
Based on the data we have so far, it looks like two areas in particular are affected. Prefrontal cortex, which is important for attention, self-control, what people sometimes call executive function, and also the hippocampus, which is a part of the brain that is important for learning and memory, and also for regulation of the stress response. So this makes perfect sense if you look back at the animal literature, where people have manipulated the amount of stress and the type of mothering that baby rats get. They find that the changes as those rats mature are in prefrontal cortex and the hippocampus, and it looks from the human data like we're seeing similar kinds of changes in people.
If you're seeing these changes in the brain and you're connecting those issues of poverty to affecting the brain, what's the consequence of that, and are the consequences short-term or long-term?
The consequences, as far as we can tell, are long-term, which is not to say irreversible, but without any kind of intervention, they seem to last into adulthood, and they influence people's academic achievement, occupational achievement, you know, a success at work. And really, we've known for decades that there's a correlation between socioeconomic status and academic and work achievement, and this is beginning to show us the mechanism by which growing up poor results in those outcomes. And let me just mention that there's terrible sort of vicious cycles and snowballing effects at work here, because for anybody, trying to get themselves out of poverty is a huge task, a daunting task that any of us would, you know, have to use all of our mental resources to accomplish. And the horrible irony is that the kids who most need those resources are, to an extent, deprived of them.
I think in many ways the neurological mapping of the mechanisms of those consequences would give us some tools for possibly compensating for some of the natural stresses that are going to occur in socioeconomically troubled neighborhoods and communities, and maybe allow kids to develop more normally because we're anticipating the stresses of poverty.
Absolutely. I mean, I think it has real practical importance because it points to aspects of childhood experience that should be targeted for change. I think it also has a kind of rhetorical importance, if you will. You know, I think there's some people out there who think, oh, well, you know, it's all very nice and sweet and sentimental to care about poor children. And, you know, of course, they're very sweet and we want everybody to have an equal opportunity and justice is nice. But if you put it in terms of, in effect, a public health issue, these adverse environments that kids are growing up in are really having a physical impact on their bodies and minds, I think it makes the issue more than just nice to try to make society more fair to poor people if you can afford it.
Professor Martha Farah, thank you. Professor Martha Farah is director of the Center for Cognitive Neuroscience at the University of Pennsylvania. Now we're joined by Femi Okeh, who's got the headlines of the hour.
At 22 minutes to the top of the hour, it's the worst holiday shopping season in decades. Early numbers show that retail sales were off as much as 8% from last year. The poor economy and bad weather are getting the blame for keeping shoppers at home. Today's the fourth anniversary of a tsunami that killed nearly a quarter of a million people in a dozen countries. Across Asia, people are marking the anniversary with candlelight vigils and prayers. Killer waves triggered by an earthquake struck the most of Asia and killed some 230,000 people, and the recovery effort has cost some $5.5 billion. President Lansana Conde of Guinea died this week. His death triggered a military takeover of the West African state. The leaders of the coup are organizing public ceremonies for the funeral of their late president, and the captain who's leading the military takeover is now calling himself President Camara.
If I've been given a chance to guide the destiny of the nation, I say I have a fundamental mission, a sacred mission, a mission tied to my culture, my religion, my education and what I have experienced. It is not to betray the nation.
Camara is planning to meet with foreign envoys later this week. Two Chinese destroyers and a supply ship have left Hainan Island in southern China for a mission off the coast of East Africa to protect Chinese shipping from pirates. The operation in waters off the east coast of Africa is China's Navy's first beyond the Pacific Ocean. And also, yesterday the German Navy apprehended some pirates, but they've actually let them go. The reason for this is because there's no legal jurisdiction for them to keep them under arrest. So those pirates will be out and about at work today. Nice
That's
to know.
That's an interesting twist on the pirate story. Thank you.
They never get a day off.
You're
those
welcome.
Pirates.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry.
And I'm Adora Udoji. A tense situation continues today in the Gaza Strip. Israel has reopened three border crossings with Gaza and is delivering humanitarian aid despite continued mortar fire from Hamas fighters. Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Olmert has hinted that he may be preparing for a military offensive in response to those mortar firings. For more on the situation there, we spoke to BBC Middle East correspondent Katya Adler in Jerusalem. And we asked her why Israel would open three border crossings in the face of this continued assault.
Well, what Israel has said all along since it imposed its very tough economic blockade on the Gaza Strip 18 months ago is that it is keen to avoid a humanitarian crisis. It put the blockade in place when Islamist Hamas seized internal control of Gaza, and that is 18 months ago. It's said that the blockade is aimed to hurt Hamas. But of course, it's ordinary families in Gaza who say that they are being hit hardest, with foodstuffs in low supply, fuel in low supply, cooking gas in low supply. And what you see is, at some point, Israel lets in more aid trucks than others. It says it reviews the situation on a daily basis. So if it judges the security situation to be such that it can let the trucks in, like today, it will do so to avoid a humanitarian crisis. Today, a few rockets and mortar shells have been fired from the Gaza Strip, but Israel says because of international pressure and because it wants to avoid a humanitarian crisis, it is allowing these very basic supplies in. But ask the aid agencies and they'll tell you it's a drop in the ocean. It's not enough at all. The last time that any aid came in was 10 days ago.
And in part, the security situation is deteriorating because a truce between Israel and Hamas essentially ended last week. Are there any signs that negotiations or have begun, or that there is going to be some conversations about extending the truce that went on for 6 months?
Well, of course, Israel and Hamas would say they don't speak to each other directly. It was Egypt that brokered the truce that lasted for 6 months and ended last Friday between Israel and the Hamas leaders in the Gaza Strip. It was an imperfect truce at best. Rockets and mortar shells continue to be fired from the Gaza Strip at Israel throughout, although for most of the time to a far lesser extent than before. There were weapons continued to be smuggled into Gaza through Egypt, which is also something that Israel had asked to be stopped. But if you look at it from the Palestinian perspective, throughout that six-month truce time, Israel maintained its tough economic blockade on Gaza. So Gazans say they felt that they were punished still throughout that truce. Yet, if you ask the civilians on both sides, the Gazans and also the Israelis, particularly those who live within the range of rocket fire and mortar shell fire, they say that a weak truce is better than none. And they are hoping that there will be a renewal. There has been talk of it. But when we look at the volleys of rockets that continue to come from the Gaza Strip over the last days, 180 according to Israel's military since last Friday, and the fact that the economic blockade is still in place over the Gaza Strip, it's looking quite bleak. There's a lot, also a war of words going on, a lot of saber rattling on both sides with a lot of threats.
Katia Adler, we thank her for her update. Katia is a Middle East BBC correspondent based in Jerusalem.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, featuring stories of responsible acts that happen every day. Stories to read, share, and respond to, available at responsibilityproject.com. Because one responsible act can make an unforgettable difference.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning. It's Friday, December 26th. Femi Okay is here with the morning's headlines.
And the time just coming up to 12 minutes to the top of the hour. Wall Street goes back to work this morning. So far, the markets are looking flat for the futures. The lawyer for Illinois Governor Rod Blagojevich wants the incoming White House chief of staff to testify about his conversations with the governor. Rahm Emanuel is just one of the high-ranking Obama officials the governor's lawyer wants subpoenaed by the Illinois legislature. Impeachment hearings are in the works. There's more bad weather on the way as a powerful storm system makes its way across the country. Colorado is the target today. Parts of that state could get up to 20 inches of snow and 80-mile-an-hour winds. The blizzard conditions have proven dangerous for skiers. Several are dead or missing from mountains in the region. There's great concern this morning that new fighting could break out in the Middle East. Palestinian militants in Gaza have stepped up rocket attacks, and now Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Olmert warns Israel is ready to attack if militants don't stand down.
I can tell you, we have the power, we have enormous power. We can do things which will be devastating.
And Gaza is primarily controlled by Hamas. Several men are now on trial in China. They're accused of making and selling the chemical melamine at the center of the tainted milk scandal, blamed for killing six children and making 300,000 other people ill. The men are accused of adding the chemical to raw milk to make it appear high in protein. State television showed them in court in handcuffs while being questioned by three judges. And that's a look at some stories making news this morning.
Thank you, Femi. So every Christmas never fails. I realize, you know, under the tree, I wish that I'd gotten a dumpster. But nobody gave me one because everything that needs to be thrown away and put away, it's enormous. And how do you deal with all the solid waste that's left over from the holidays? I mean, that's the challenge. That's the question. I mean, you got the trees, you got all the wrapping, you got the food. We thought we'd ask Megan O'Neill, the founder and editor of TreeHugger.com, who comes to us from Providence, Rhode Island, who knows all about how to dispose of things for the holidays in a green way. Megan, thanks for being a part of the program, and happy holidays to you.
Oh, happy holidays to you, too. Thanks for having me.
So I need a dumpster to deal with all of the just solid waste that's generated. I got four kids, so you can imagine what the situation is there. But I always feel, as I'm either burning it up or throwing it away, that there's got to be a better way. What's your suggestion?
Well, interestingly, I think what you've just described is sort of a microcosm of what happens in society at large, right? We think about everything to do with a product or a thing until it's time to get rid of it. And the holidays, of course, is when that's most apparent. So, you know, the mostly what we're seeing is we've got, you know, if you're a Christmas tree person, you've got a Christmas tree. We've got tons of paper and packaging. We've got lots of leftover food. So we've got all this stuff, and we haven't thought about it until it's right there and you need the dumpster. And with four kids, I only have one kid, but with four kids, I can imagine it's a lot.
Well, you have thought about it. So let's start with the tree and then move to, say, the paper. And I'd love some suggestions about what I can do in gift giving that would make other people's solid waste problems a little easier to solve.
Sure. Well, starting with the Christmas tree, which is, I think there's something like 30 million of them sold every year. So it's a pretty big waste stream there. The most important thing is that you want to make sure that it's properly disposed of. And that means that it's going to get mulched, basically, and not landfilled. Most cities have a curbside program now, or they have a place where you can bring it and dispose of it properly. What you don't want to have happen is for it to go straight to the landfill, because that means it's going to sit there and rot, not decompose. So it's going to be creating a lot of methane, basically, which is one of the most strong greenhouse gases.
Whereas if you mulch it, it actually contributes to plant growth and therefore produces oxygen as opposed to methane.
Exactly. It's going to get reabsorbed back into a natural system. It's going to help things grow, and that's the proper way to dispose of it.
All right, what about wrapping paper, boxes, plastic, say, you know, jewel cases from CDs, that sort of thing?
Yeah. Well, interestingly, our trash output between Thanksgiving and New Year's goes up about 25% in America.
Oh, my God. That's embarrassing.
Yeah, and then consider that probably one of the biggest waste streams from the holidays is paper from all the things you just,
right,
you know, described. paper is actually the biggest contributor to our landfills. It's taking up more than a third of our landfills. But most paper is recyclable. So you really want to get that wrapping paper into the, you know, recycling bin. You want to reuse it. You want to make sure that it's not getting landfilled.
All right, but that sounds like a complete pain because we have to tie up the newspapers in bundles, but how do you deal with folding and disposing of wrapping paper that kids have like torn off of a box?
Well, it probably depends on what the rules are where you live, but I know where I live, we can just shove any kind of paper right into the recycling bin.
And Megan, I recycle all of that, the packaging, the foam that you get, the wrapping paper. It drives my husband bananas. But what I've discovered is if you keep some of the foam and some of the packaging, you can actually donate that to a local organization, particularly any ones that have children and they are involved in arts and craft. And so it's like an extra bonus around the holiday time.
Yeah, you know, it takes a little bit more organization to be able to, you know, to do that in a way that's convenient. But if you're thinking about these things ahead of time, you can really get it together and make sure that the waste is not becoming waste, but being channeled back into what we would call recycling or even upcycling, which is the idea that you're using something for something even more useful or as useful as it once was.
Now, would you suggest particular strategies for shipping, or are there particular items and ingredients in this whole Christmas shipping, shopping business that you would absolutely avoid at all costs?
Well, I think when it comes to shipping, what you want to, I mean, certainly you want to avoid styrofoam packing peanuts, I think would be a big one, but those can be reused. If you're shipping stuff, you want to think about shipping things that are smaller, you know, and packing things concisely so that you're not shipping around tons of air. Obviously, you know, the fuel that's used to ship things is a big deal, whether that's something that's coming from a manufacturer to a retailer or from person to person. So that would be the first thing. And I think for the idea of shopping is, you know, the greenest thing that you can do is buy something that's useful for somebody and that's a quality gift, whether or not it's made from eco-friendly materials. So the idea of sort of cutting down on the crap is a good idea. sort of
cut
the first
crap.
Idea when
there.
It comes to
there
when it go. Comes to shopping.
I hear
yeah.
you. Now, what about Christmas lights and Christmas decorations? Are those things recyclable?
Many of them are, and one of the things that we encourage for, you know, the winter holidays and any time is really to decorate with natural materials, which can be composted or aren't just, you know, a lot of plastic stuff that you've got to store, that you've got to, you know, it came from China, that sort of thing, sort of falls into the crap category.
It came from China. Let me just quiz you with something before we go, all right?
Sure.
I got a number for you. 132,903 is the number of what?
That is the number of plastic Christmas trees that are imported from China in a typical year.
Wow.
So, you know, I'm not completely against the idea of the plastic Christmas tree, but what happens is that those are, of course, made from plastic, so that means oil, being shipped from China, more oil, and then really the sad thing is that people aren't using them for very long.
So you're
going to get a...
If you're saving a tree, if you think you're saving a tree by getting a plastic one, think again. I guess the lesson there is use it for a long time.
Use it for a long, long time, and then pass it on when you're done with it.
And don't let Megan O'Neill see you throwing that thing away until you've used it enough. But Megan O'Neill is the founder of TreeHugger.com, and she joined us to talk about recycling techniques for disposing of Christmas waste. Thanks, Megan.
Thank you.
Megan.
It's freaky enough to buy a fake Christmas tree, but that you would throw it away after just a couple of years, that's insane.
She's good with the
She's
numbers.
Great. She's great, though.
Yeah, but people do a lot of what you would consider, John, insane things.
All right. Be nice.
No, but or I would consider no. insane. We're no. just a country of nutty people.
Nutty people with streaks, and we're talking about streaks today. The L.A. Lakers and the Celtics last night got together, and it ended the longest winning streak in Boston basketball history. What's your favorite streak? It can be sports, but it doesn't have to be.
My favorite streak in my life was the streak I counted of days I went without having a cigarette. That was the way I quit smoking.
That's a good one.
He
a
didn't
very
say how
healthy
long it was.
Kind of streak. But he said he quit smoking, though. So
no, that's right.
It
yeah,
must
so
be
I
a continued streak,
day.
Which
yeah.
is a good one. So congratulations to you. But what kind of streak do you like? 8778 My Take or My Take at thetakeaway.org. Let's hear your story.
And here's your takeaway.
We need to focus on those people we have lost, and we need to reconnect with younger America.
That's David Frum, resident fellow at the American Enterprise Institute on the future of the Republican Party. We're always on here at The Takeaway. If you missed anything, take our podcast to go. Subscribe now at thetakeaway.org or iTunes.
David Frum said no more Sarah Palins. I was actually kind of
no
surprised
more Harriet Myers.
Yeah, yeah.
No more Brownie.
No
he
more
was Brownie. Referring.
No more Brownie, I can figure.
Right.
I'm John Hockenberry.
I'm Adora Udoji, and this is The Takeaway.
Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. The Rockefeller Foundation and its campaign for American workers. More at rockfound.org. And by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is The Takeaway. Ow.
okay, kids, I want this living room cleaned up or you're all grounded.
If you ever carried out your proposed threat, you would experience such a storm of consequences, my friend, that your empty little head would be spinning faster than the wheels of your Schwinn bicycle back there.
All right, that's not my son. But that day after Christmas weekend, what do you do now? Dilemma, we have it. Lots of time, too many guests, not lots of post-holiday energy or cash. We called in the professionals for some answers. Hint, John Malkovich and the Coen brothers meet Sesame Street. We'll explain it all on The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Nothing like starting the morning off with John Malkovich.
Yes.
Good morning.
Friend.
It's Friday. It's December 26th. Good morning, John.
Good morning, Adora.
Today, a critique of President-elect Obama by a progressive. Travel tips in a recession. Get this. One expert says the airline industry is actually in good shape. Plus, China and growing U.S. debt. Those stories are coming up first, these headlines.
The lawyer for Illinois Governor Rod Blagojevich wants the incoming White House chief of staff to testify about his conversations with the governor. Rahm Emanuel is just one of the high-ranking Obama officials the governor's lawyer wants subpoenaed by the Illinois legislature. Impeachment hearings are in the works there. There are reports of growing tension between two nuclear-armed powers. Thousands of Pakistani troops appear to be on the move to the country's border with India. Tensions are high in the wake of the Mumbai attacks, which are a month old today. India blames the shootings on Pakistan-based militants. India and Pakistan have gone to war three times since independence from Britain in 1947.
Tensions are also high in the Middle East, where they're bracing for a new round of fighting between Israel and Hamas. Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Olmert warned Gaza militants to halt rocket attacks.
Telling them now, it may be the last minute. I'm telling them. Stop it. We are stronger. There will be more blood there. Who wants it? We don't want it.
Gaza is primarily controlled by Hamas. Here in the U.S., western states are in for one snowy day. A winter storm system is moving across the country, and Colorado is in the crosshairs. 20 inches of snow could cover part of the state's west. Winds could reach 80 miles per hour. Yes, that's 20 inches of snow and 80 miles per hour wins.
Good news for shoppers today, potentially, but it comes because holiday shopping season was so slow. Sellers need to make money before year's end. Retailers around the country are pulling out all the stops to spur spending. Huge markdowns, sales in stores. This is new data from tracking group Spending Pulse shows retail sales could be down as much as 8%. For some retailers, holiday shopping accounts for half their yearly sales.
China is the latest nation to join the fight against pirates off the coast of Somalia. Several Chinese warships are on the way there now. This after German forces yesterday foiled a hijacking.
Mixed bag on markets. The Dow Jones Industrial Average are poised to open flat or slightly positive this morning, but volumes are low at this end of the year period. We're talking streaks today, though. The LA Lakers beat the Boston Celtics last night to end their longest winning streak in Celtics history. What's your favorite streak, sports or otherwise? Tell us your stories at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org.
Once I beat my mom twice in a row in Scrabble. Twice. That was a streak in my house.
She didn't let that go on.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at knightfoundation.org. And by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everyone. So think of it. Adora's streak of winning over her mother in Scrabble only lasted two games, but it was an important streak for her.
It was very important.
We're talking about streaks today. Last night, the Boston Celtics' 19 winning game streak came to an end. The LA Lakers beat them. It was a record for the Boston Celtics, but we want to know what's a winning streak or a favorite streak in your life.
Hello, this is Rick Wolf from Chicago, Illinois, and of course the greatest streak most infamous is the Chicago Cubs winless streak of not getting to the World Series for 100 years. That's got to be the best streak.
You could do the Detroit Lions winless record streak this year.
Sadly, this year.
877-8 my take or my take at thetakeaway.org.
As we take a look back at 2008, as we move quickly into 2009, some might say that 2008 really was the year of the donkey. The Democrats swept the House, Senate, and the presidency. But with the economy in shambles and two wars still being waged in Afghanistan and Iraq, what will the next year look like for progressives? For that, we turn to Christopher Hayes, the Washington editor for The Nation and a fellow at the New America Foundation, for his thoughts. Welcome, Christopher.
Thanks for having me.
We've seen lots of words describing Barack Obama's action so far as pragmatic, and that's something you take an issue with. Explain.
Well, I think there's a good meaning of pragmatic, and I can sort of elaborate on that. But what's frustrated me is that I think the word has become a kind of cipher whereby the defenders of the status quo have kind of seized on it, and the coded meaning of it is essentially he won't rock the boat, he won't challenge the wise old men of Washington, and don't worry too much, he's going to fit right in with this kind of permanent governing class and establishment. And I think that's dangerous, because I think the permanent governing class and the establishment are a huge reason that we're in the mess we're in now.
Well, what about Obama's definition itself? He has said pragmatism to him means not deferring to one ideology or the other for the sake of it.
Yeah, for the sake of it, I guess, is the crucial phrase there. I think that there's two ways of understanding pragmatism. The bad way of understanding pragmatism, and the way that I think it's understood here in Washington, is people who are, quote, non-ideological, who don't have an ideology. And I think that's actually just self-delusional. I mean, everybody has some set of principles and values and a worldview out of which they operate. The other way of understanding pragmatism is to be aware of one's own worldviews and principles and ideology and try to operate with a kind of radical open-mindedness. Now, that, I think, is salutary, and I think particularly after a very closed-minded, faith-based presidency we've had for the last 8 years, is a virtue, if that can be developed. But it's very different than having some sort of conception of oneself as being somehow outside of ideology, which I think is very dangerous.
Well, what is the ideology then that is you can extrapolate from, say, the appointment of Rahm Emanuel, a very clear establishment Clintonian, and the keeping of Gates in the Pentagon, a sort of a continuity approach to one of the most controversial issues in modern American history, the Iraq War?
Yeah, I think that it's important to sort of separate what they're kind of what from the perspective of the Obama people are kind of instrumental tactical moves and what their strategic ends are, and that's the big question everyone's wondering. If Robert Gates is, you know, deftly employed so as to bring the Iraq War to a close, then I think, you know, people would be happy with that. If he's used as a mechanism to continue the occupation, then people won't be. I will say that I think, you know, look, the president of the country is generally going to fit into the ideological space relatively close to both the center of the country and certainly the center of his party. And I think that's true of Barack Obama. He's essentially in the center of the Democratic Party ideologically. And I don't think that's necessarily surprising. I mean, the mechanisms by which someone gets elected president, push towards the center as a kind of definitional matter.
And that's not necessarily a bad thing. In fact, if you look at our Constitution and the way the Founding Fathers set things up, the idea was to sort of reach that middle that is acceptable to the most number of people. But let's talk about some of the other people that he has selected and hope will become his nominees for cabinet positions. When you take a look at all of those people, John mentioned two, but then there's Bill Richardson and there's Hillary Clinton as Secretary of State. Does that say to you that he has left progressivism behind?
No, I wouldn't. I think that would be an overstatement.
What are you talking about? If we're going to have a redux of the Clinton era, that's not a disaster for progressives?
Well, no. I mean, the point is that what constitutes a redux, right? The question is the redux personnel or is the redux policy? And as seeing as how he hasn't governed for a single day yet, it seems a touch premature to draw the conclusion that we are seeing a full-fledged redux. I mean, you know, there is a mix of people who are you know, associated with the Clintonites, and there are some new people. Look, like I said before, I mean, when, you know, let's remember when George Bush came in, he chose a lot of people from the Ford administration. And the Bush administration, I think we can all agree, did not particularly resemble the Ford administration.
It sure didn't.
So you know, you can read too much in. You could say, oh, Donald Rumsfeld's back and Dick Cheney's back and all the Fordies are back. They're totally going to launch a preemptive war against Iraq. Well, no one thought that because, you know.
It's a good answer, Christopher, I have to say, because it felt like you were pulling your punches and trying to get a cabinet position in the Obama administration for a moment. But that's actually a good answer.
That's out of the question.
But what's your measurement then? As Barack Obama continues to make news, as he prepares to take office, as he begins governing, how are you going to be measuring what he's doing and who he's appointing to do those things?
Look, here's my point. I mean, one way of conceiving of this relationship is an interest group relationship, right? Which is that progressives are an interest group and they want to see some degree of representation. And that's actually true, and that's perfectly fine, and that's the way politics work. The much more important thing is substantive outcomes. I mean, what I want to see is us avoid a Great Depression, avoid widespread immiseration of the populace, avoid massive job loss, skyrocketing unemployment, the continuation in perpetuity.
Skyrocketing foreclosures, more people uninsured.
Yeah, so the metrics have much more to do with the actual outcomes and, you know, life experience of the populace than they have to do with who is sitting in what position. Who is sitting in what position right now are perhaps the best we can do as indications of the direction he will take policy, but that's only because we don't have any kind of substantive governing agenda to judge yet.
So then the only way you're going to be able to judge him is 4 years from now and what the end results are for the policies that he's instituted.
Well, no, I mean, there's going to be legislation presumably passed in the interim, right? I mean, there's going to be a stimulus package. That stimulus package will...
Yeah, but they can pass them. But the question is, if you're saying it's about results, then we're not going to know for some significant period of time. I mean, clearly the economy is in trouble. It's not going to change overnight.
No, it's not. And look, I mean, that's, you know, ultimately the kind of ultimate accountability is going to be 4 years from now in the re-election. But
well, let's talk legislation then. Do you support an essentially a nationalized infrastructure program for development of comprehensive, repairs and building all over the United States, or leave it to the private sector?
Oh, absolutely the former. I mean, I think there's been tremendous underinvestment by the private sector and a real kind of misallocation of investment dollars. I think that is something that's become apparent in the wake of the housing bubble. What we have done is built a lot of McMansions and cornfields, and what we haven't done is build the kind of broadband infrastructure we need, et cetera. So I think there's a huge role for public investment of basic infrastructure, both physical infrastructure, high-speed rail, broadband, et cetera. And I think that, you know, moving in that direction, I think there's actually a sort of heartening consensus that's beginning to form around those kinds of expenditures.
But you also acknowledge that the events of the day may overshadow the ability of the administration to come up with those kind of priorities when you first have to deal with something like the economy and two wars.
Well, sure. I mean, I'm not quite sure what specifically you mean. I mean, I think that it's generally true that at this point, in a way that I don't think has necessarily been paralleled in years, with perhaps the exception of the aftermath of 9/11, I think events are driving policy in a way, particularly on the domestic front,
right,
that we haven't seen in a long time. And and basically what we have seen since September is a very ad hoc and reactive approach, which I think has produced a lot of really bad policy. I mean, so what you do want to see is everyone in Washington be more proactive in the way that they're going to approach economic recovery.
There's something to wish for in 2009, proactivity. Christopher Hayes, thank you. Hayes is the Washington editor for The Nation and a fellow at the New America Foundation.
I mean, we're really going to see if this is an opportunity for big ideas and big policy shifts or if it's going to be reactive. I think he actually lays it out, what we need to look for next year, pretty clearly.
I think he does, but the question is, how much time do you get in order to make it clear that you're doing one or the other? Nah. Like, at what point does he just get slammed because he's not doing exactly what any particular group wants him to do?
Politics.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual, dedicated to helping safeguard businesses and employees through comprehensive insurance products and services. More information at libertymutualgroup.com. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. Well, some people like to talk about their sustained streaks of sobriety, and those are life and death matters. Other streaks are memorable. They're not life or death, but sports streaks, for instance, are certainly, you know, great to talk about. The L.A. Lakers topped the Boston Celtics last night in L.A. to end the longest winning streak in Celtics history. What's your favorite streak?
Yes, hi. My favorite streak was in eighth grade. There was a softball throw, that record that was unbroken for about 8 years, and it was set by the gym teacher's son. Everyone knew I was going to break it, and on that day, fortunately, I did.
A lot of pressure, but good work there. Call 877-8-MY-TAKE or MyTAKE at thetakeaway.org with your favorite streak.
There are many people who have traveled this month who are hoping that into 2009, those crowded airports are not going to continue, that that is going to be a streak that will be broken.
Air misery, is going to come
crowded,
to
delayed, being stuck, sleeping in cots at airports. Many people hoping that that will not continue in 2009. And we're looking for some answers as to what travel is going to look like in the next coming year. Barbara Peterson, a senior aviation correspondent for Condé Nast Traveler. She joins us now with her thoughts about 2009 travel. Welcome, Barbara.
It's great to be here.
And what a year it's been in air travel. I think many of us would have thought at this point we'd be talking about a bailout package for the airlines given the ups and downs of oil prices this past year.
Yes, well, that actually would have been, I think, a topic in the past. And, of course, right after 9/11, the airlines did get a direct handout from the government. However, though, these are different times. The airlines, strangely, are actually in a better shape now because they've been through the crisis. You know, the last few years, they've lost almost $30 billion. And most major airlines actually went into Chapter 11 bankruptcy, which sort of acts kind of like a rinse cycle. You know, it gets them, they don't have to pay their bills for a while. They can get their house in order, and they did. And then just as it looked like they were turning the corner, then the oil prices spiked. So then they had another crisis hit. And again, what they did was shrink even further. So now it looks like they may actually be in better shape than a lot of other industries, believe it or not.
So in 2009, if the airlines are in better shape, what is that going to mean for consumers who are flying? More consistent prices for seats on planes, less crowded planes, more joyous occasion to travel.
Or any joy at all.
Any joy at all, right, going to the airport.
Well, I wish I could give you that prediction, but I'm afraid, reality has to set in here. If the airlines have their way, planes will be fuller than ever, and here's the reason why. They have shrunk their capacity so they can get demand more in line with supply. See, the problem in the past is there were just too many seats chasing too few passengers, which is great for passengers. That means the airlines have to resort to a lot of discounting to fill those seats. Now what they've done, though, is they've parked more than 500 planes, probably out in some desert somewhere. That is the equivalent of a major airline suddenly vanishing overnight. Okay, that has really shrunk the capacity. It's more than 15% overall of available seats. So, yes, there will be fewer flights, but they will be still full. Now, that all does depend on the economy. If the economy continues this tailspin, then the airlines, of course, will have trouble even filling those reduced number of seats. And we will see fare sales. There are always fare sales. They're never going to go away. And what I advise consumers is look for Southwest. That's always what I say. Look for where they're going. Look for where they're flying, because fares inevitably go down when they enter a city.
I want to get your thought on something that Bob Crandall told us, the former chairman of American Airlines. He said he thought that we should be treating the airlines like a utility. that they need to be part of a national travel policy and set up in a way where it's most efficient for us to get where we need to go.
Oh, yes. I'm familiar with his calls for sort of a re-regulation of the airline business. And I think that's interesting because American Airlines was one of the airlines that profited the most, actually, from deregulation.
Yeah, right. No kidding.
But, no, I think he has an interesting point. I think a lot of the reason why the system still strikes a lot of us as dysfunctional is not so much the airline side, it's the airport and the airways. It's the air traffic control system, which is really outmoded, and that has been overdue for modernization for a long time. And so, therefore, you know, we have a very inefficient system. We have airports that have too many flights scheduled to go than they can handle. We have other airports that are underutilized. And I think he feels that the government has sort of just basically taken a back seat to all of this in the last 8 years.
So if you could sum up what you think some of the things travelers need to keep in mind as they head to the airport this year, what would be that one or two things?
Well, I'd say, first of all, look for the airports where things aren't as crowded. You still have some choices. Even though they're contracting flights dramatically, you can certainly get better deals if you're creative. The other way to be creative is to watch out for those fees. You know, the airlines have been piling on the fees, and they're essentially charging for anything that isn't bolted down. Not all airlines charge the same fees. Try to pack light. Try not to check a bag because, you know, they'll charge you for it and they may lose it, too.
Charge it and lose it. Not a good combination. Well, thank you very much, Barbara Peterson. Barbara Peterson is a senior aviation correspondent at Condé Nast Traveler, and those were just a few thoughts to keep in mind as you head to the airport. Now we turn to Femi Oke, who's got the headlines for us.
Hello there. The time is 27 minutes past the hour. Top Obama aide Rahm Emanuel may have to testify about his contacts with Illinois Governor Rod Blagojevich.
Don't you love that? Blagojevich's lawyer is a genius.
There's a certain amount of drama involved with this.
Oh, my yes. God. He's sure. Got all the cards, that guy.
And the timing couldn't be better, really, could it? Right. The governor's lawyer wants the incoming White House chief of staff and other top Obama officials subpoenaed by the Illinois legislature. Impeachment hearings are now in the works. In world markets, it was a mixed bag in Asia this morning. Major European markets are closed today for the Christmas holiday. Wall Street took yesterday off, but traders there are back to work in a little under 2 minutes' time. More than a dozen are dead after a riot and jailbreak in Iraq. The dead include both security guards and insurgent prisoners. Several insurgents managed to escape. Iraqi police say the prisoners involved were all suspected of al-Qaeda in Iraq, and they're expected to be members of al-Qaeda and working out of Iraq, I should say. China is the latest nation to join the fight against pirates off the coast of Somalia. Several Chinese warships are on their way there now, and other countries have sent gunboats recently to secure the busy shipping lane. Just yesterday, German forces stopped a hijacking there, but there is a but to that story when the German naval officer actually stopped the hijackers and the pirates. He actually had to let them go after disarming them. And finally, your sports story of the day. Boston Celtics, their winning streak is over. The LA Lakers ended it with a Christmas Day win. And the Celtics still have the best record, though, in NBA basketball. And let's look at your news for now.
Thank you, Femi.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation and its Campaign for American Workers. More at rockfound.org.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual, dedicated to celebrating personal responsibility and to proving its own with a comprehensive array of auto insurance products. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility, what's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning on this Friday, December 26th. And we're thinking about streaks this morning, sports streaks, especially after last night. The Boston Celtics, well, their streak was broken after the LA Lakers beat them. What about you? What do you think about streaks?
My favorite streak right now is I'm watching in horror and fascination as my team, the Detroit Lions, becomes the worst team in history.
That's a tough one. What's
Hang
your
there,
favorite
dude.
Streak, though? Perhaps you've been like in our family. It's a game about Scrabble. Who's up and who's down? And I'm down this year in 2008, but I'm hopeful for 2009. What about you, 8778 My Take or My Take, thetakeaway.org?
I love people sharing these streak ideas with us. You know, we've gotten a full range of stuff. It's caused me to think about sort of streaks in the past. But this is a day, you know, this is the first time I worked on Christmas, I think, in probably 8 years of my professional life.
And you enjoyed it so much.
I did. No, I had a great time. We had a great time. It was really, really good. But now, you know, when the show's over, we got to go home, and you know, we got a whole day. Guests are there. You know, what are you going to do? A lot of free time. It's a long holiday weekend, and you can't just let it slip away. It's a predicament for me and everyone on the planet, I think, this holiday season. Getting paid to solve the problem of reasonable things to do with all this free time is our friend Allison Williams. She's associate editor at Time Out New York. And Allison, thanks for grappling with this problem for us. I mean, you've got something for us to listen to, something for us to watch, something for us to read, and something for us to avoid at all costs, right?
Well, the great thing about the end of the year is that you get to kind of catch up with things. And the one thing you really have to listen to is the soundtrack to Slumdog Millionaire, which is a movie. It came out a couple months ago. It is by Danny Boyle, the guy who did the movie Trainspotting. It's set in India, and the music is a bunch of Indian music, as well as some songs you might recognize, like this one.
Wow, you're really at home here, Allison. Yeah. You're cueing our director already. Okay, that's familiar to us.
Yeah, this song, it's called Paper Planes by an artist named M.I.A., and it's been out for about a year. So you may have heard it on the radio, in the store. It's a little too loud while you're shopping, that sort of thing. It plays a pretty big role in the movie, and it's a really accessible, it's a fun song. It's on my gym mix. But what's great about the soundtrack, it doesn't just have this recognizable song. It's also got some great Indian music by a really famous composer, a guy by the name of A.R. Rahman.
Nice. Would we call this Bhangra?
Well, you know, it's a combination of a bunch of different styles. And this guy, A.R. Rahman, huge in India, has sold over 100 million albums. He's been nominated for a Golden Globe for this.
And lots of videos. Yeah. You watch MTV India, right? Mm-hmm. All of those little mini videos that look like Bollywood movies. He's got a lot of those.
And it's really fun music. It's good for working out. It's good for just sort of setting a good atmosphere. And it really, it's a fun movie. It's a movie that's going to get a lot of attention. So
soundtrack from Slumdog Millionaire.
Yes,
that's the listen.
Absolutely.
All right.
But if you're sitting around, you want to stay at home, the DVD for the movie Burn After Reading is going to be coming out. And this is a movie that came out a couple of months ago again. And
great movie.
Did okay in the box office. You know, had a couple of big stars, people you might have heard of.
Coen Brothers, right?
It's by the Coen Brothers. It's a little more like Fargo, a movie they did, than No Country for Old Men, which they did last year. So, you know, don't worry, there's not that much blood. Here's John Malkovich right here.
The unauthorized dissemination of classified material is a federal crime. If you ever carried out your proposed threat, you would experience such a storm of consequences, my friend, that your empty little head would be spinning faster than the wheels of your Schwinn bicycle back there.
You think that's a Schwinn?
Only Malkovich can make you nervous and laugh at the same time. And that's Brad Pitt also.
Yes, Brad Pitt at the end. And these are some really professional, big actors who are having so much fun.
It's a hilarious film. Yeah. That soundbite gives you a sense of his intensity, but it's very funny.
Yes, it's kind of a crime caper, but it's a bunch of really stupid people getting caught up in crime. It's a lot of fun. It's one you could watch with your parents if your parents are okay with a few curse words, the occasional funny sex joke.
Or your kids, maybe.
Yeah.
all right, so we got one thing to listen to, mm-hmm. one thing to watch. What else?
Well, the next thing, if you're going to sit at home, here's a song you might recognize from your childhood.
Oh, well.
Yeah. Or if you have kids.
It's the theme from Captain Kangaroo, right?
probably the most famous children's show out there. There's a book coming out called Street Gang, The Complete History of Sesame Street by Michael Davis. And this covers the beginning of the show, the concept, Jim Henson coming up with this idea, developing the Muppets. And you really get to hear about how the show came about and how they how they turned it into such a phenomenon. It's really great. You get to read about how Jim Henson and Frank Oz went in to pick up the Bert and Ernie puppets for the first time.
That's cool.
And they're going back and forth, and they really had kind of a Bert and Ernie friendship between the two of them. So it's really sweet, at least for me. I mean, I grew up on the show. I love the show. It's neat to hear about the backstory of what was going on, what was happening.
All right, so what do we avoid at all costs?
Okay, well, if you may have heard a show called The Hills, it's set in California, and it's a reality show following a couple of young women out there. There's a spinoff that's going to be premiering on MTV called The City. And it follows a woman named Whitney Port, who was on The Hills, and now she has come to New York City to work in fashion. Now, the thing about this show is everything's kind of in broad quotes. She's working in fashion, but it's rather staged, and there's a lot of sort of vacant conversation. Here's an example.
Hey, honey! Oh, my God!
How are you?
I have, like, an invisible tattoo on my forehead that says, make out with me, and only guys who live on futons can read it.
Make out with me and only guys that live on futons can read it.
There's a writer who's responsible for that. Huh?
If you're really nostalgic for those days in your 20s when you had too much to drink or had nothing important to say, then this show might be for you.
All the things you're trying to forget.
Yes. You know, most of us are trying to repress those memories, but it's vacancy on top of vacancy, really.
All right. Well, Allison Williams, that's great. Allison Williams is associate editor of Time Out New York. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
And, of course, there's nothing vacant about our own Femi Okeh, who's got the headlines.
Oh, that's very kind of you. Good morning. 21 minutes to the top of the hour. The police in Los Angeles have released more details of a bloody attack by a man who turned up at a suburban home dressed as Santa Claus. He killed at least 8 people. Police Chief Kim Rainey spoke to NBC today.
He simply knocked the door when the 8-year-old girl answered the door, shot her once in the face, and then entered the house and just indiscriminately started shooting.
It's a terrible Christmas Day story.
Horrible. It's just, it's horrifying.
So authorities will continue searching the house today. It's possible that more people could be found at the murder scene. The gunman, Bruce Jeffrey Pardo, set the house on fire before killing himself. And police say that an ugly divorce that was finalized last week was behind the attack. It's been 4 years since a tsunami killed nearly 250,000 people in a dozen countries. Across Asia, people are marking the anniversary with candlelight vigils and prayers. These are some monks actually having a memorial for the people killed in the 2004 tsunami earlier on today. You may remember that the huge waves triggered by an earthquake struck about a dozen countries and killed some 230,000 people. The fourth anniversary of Asia's tsunami today. And that's a look at stories making headlines this morning.
Thank you, Femi.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
Good morning. This is The Takeaway. I'm Adora Udoji.
And I'm John Hockenberry. And on this holiday weekend, we're saying goodbye to someone who was pretty hard to categorize.
They asked me how I knew my true love was true.
Eartha Kitt passed away yesterday at age 81. Listen to that. Her mother was part African-American and part Cherokee, she used to say. Her father, Dutch and German. She grew up on a cotton plantation in South Carolina, was born in 1927. In her 20s, she became a singer, using her unusual yet alluring voice. Sang all kinds of songs in all kinds of styles. Was a dancer, an actress, a writer. She wrote 3 books, won Emmys, and 2 Tony Awards for her work on Broadway in Timbuktu and The Wild Party. In 1950, she collaborated with another eccentric genius polymath, Orson Welles, on stage and romantically. He called her the most exciting woman in the world. In 1953, her surprise hit, Santa Baby, made her a familiar voice to almost anyone with a record player in the 50s and 60s. And my kids today are constantly playing Santa Baby.
I don't know if it means more than any others, but that's the song that I'm identified, I think, with more probably than any others, particularly here in America, because you can hear that song everywhere you go around Christmas time.
And you're going to be hearing Santa Baby a lot more this weekend in all the remembrances. And also this, I think.
It was wonderful and
I loved it. I wish they had asked me to do the movies.
You had an interest in doing them, I would bet.
I would have done the movies, no matter how trashy the movies are.
Eartha Kitt was brought in as a replacement to be Catwoman in the Batman show, and of course she made it, like every other role she ever played, her very own. Eartha Kitt, you see, could handle any style. That 1983 hit was her only gold record, and she was pretty candid about how Eartha Kitt created the sultry, androgynous, tough-as-nails woman singer persona, and that people like Madonna are just imitators.
I wish the hell I was making the kind of money they make by imitating Eartha Kitt, but what the hell? Business is business, and they do what they do. And
so we thought we'd leave you with two songs of Eartha Kitt that showcase her classic voice and jazz intensity. An intensity that speaks from another age.
While tearing off a game of golf, I may make a play for the caddy. But when I do, I don't follow through, 'cause my heart belongs to daddy. If I invite...
Oh, that's the best. That vibrato. I mean, you saw her on stage, right?
I have, and she was just a force of nature. Yeah. Such a tiny woman, an electric presence. She was just a consummate professional.
Played the Carlisle here in New York. But my favorite Eartha Kitt song is this one.
Love is a simple thing. Love is a silver ring. More fun than a puppet show. Bright as a scarlet bow. Love is the thunder and rain. Is a pink balloon, sad as an old buffoon, wild as a storm at sea. Love is sheer insanity. Love is a touch of spring, and it gives you a sudden grace. Love is a special face. Love is a simple thing.
Love may be a simple thing, but not Eartha Kitt. She gave us 81 years and died yesterday on Christmas Day.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, featuring stories of responsible acts that happen every day. Stories to read, share, and respond to, available at responsibilityproject.com. Because one responsible act can make an unforgettable difference.
Listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning. It's Friday, December 26th. Femi Oke is here with the headlines.
Good morning. The time is just coming up to 12 minutes to the top of the hour. Give us your money, please. We'll make a deal. That's what retailers want you to know today. They're hoping to recover from a lousy holiday sales season by getting you to spend money after Christmas. Sales and offers are everywhere. If early sales numbers hold, there could be layoffs at retail chains. Britt Beamer of America's Research Group expects big job cuts.
I would say that probably 20 to 30% of most chain stores this Christmas underperformed, and that's a recipe for disaster long term.
Early data show that total retail sales could be down as much as 8%. Wall Street traders are back to business after a Christmas break. Futures saw the markets kind of flat. John, can you just check them out for me while I get to the next bit of the story? Major European markets closed today. Most Asian markets went to work and closed mixed. And how are we doing?
It's like a 0.5% up. The volumes are really, really light. I think everyone's given up on the market for this year.
All right, that's just a few more days to go. There are reports of growing tension between two nuclear-armed nations. Thousands of Pakistani troops appear to be on the move to the country's border with India. Tensions are high in the wake of the Mumbai attacks. Actually, today is exactly a month since the Mumbai attacks happened. India blames the shootings on Pakistan-based militants. Pakistan and India have gone to war three times since independence from the UK in 1947. And the U.S. says that a coalition strike on the Taliban killed 11 fighters. One of them apparently led a bomb-making cell responsible for striking NATO soldiers. And that's all I have for you for this morning. Take care.
Thanks very much, Femi. We're going to turn to the U.S. relationship with China, and we're talking about money. It's no secret the U.S. owes massive amounts of debt to China. All of that lending has helped to fund American consumption and got America primed for a collapse. At least that's what some people argue. Mark Landler is the international economics correspondent for the New York Times, and he's just written a piece in today's paper explaining just how we became addicted to Chinese goods and to Chinese money. Good morning and welcome, Mark.
Good morning. Good morning, Adora.
Why don't we start with, clearly the United States owes, or at least China holds, somewhere in the neighborhood of $500 billion in U.S. Treasury bonds. What does that mean for our economy?
Well, one of the things it's meant for our economy is that interest rates have actually been lower over this period of time than they otherwise would have been because the Chinese demand for American securities has driven down the yields on those securities. And so it's a little bit complicated, but basically the argument is that by keeping our interest rates artificially lower, the Chinese, in effect, allowed the United States to set off on a lot of the consumption binge of the last 10 years, which contributed to the housing bubble and to the crisis that we're now in. The point is not to obviously blame the Chinese for American misery. It's merely to show that in this chain of economic events, you can actually track it back to the interaction between our economy and their economy. And in a globalized world, you can't really think of any major open economy in isolation. So what we're trying to do is show how decisions and trends made in China have had this effect on our structure, our economic structure here, and indeed have helped to reinforce some of our bad habits economically.
But isn't there some irony here in that the U.S. and China's economy, their fates are now tied together?
Absolutely. There's a very famous British historian named Neil Ferguson, and he's written a lot on this theme, and he says that the two countries are now so intertwined that you really ought to think of them as Chimerica, not as China and America. And his point is that the intertwining is not just on the level of cheap Chinese exports that they ship to Walmart that we buy and that we run a huge trade deficit with China. That part of the story is pretty well understood. I think what's interesting is what happens next, which is that the Chinese take the money mm-hmm. that we give them for their products, and they then recycle it into our American government debt. And the reason they do that is because they have enormous savings in their country that they generate because their economy, unlike ours, is not driven by consumption. It's driven by exports. It's driven by what they sell to us as to what they sell to their own people. So they have this enormous storehouse of savings, over $1 trillion, and they need to put it somewhere. And one of the safest, most reliable places to put investments in the world is treasury bonds and treasury bills. And until very recently, there was also a very major push into the debt issued by Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac,
right?
Because they're also guaranteed by the U.S. government. So the Chinese recycled all this money right back into our economy in the form of this investment. And the investment then had all these other effects on the economy in terms of interest rates, our inflation rate, and giving us the wherewithal to continue consuming at a level that was arguably beyond our means.
It's interesting, as you're explaining this, in my mind, I'm visualizing sort of a gerbil track. It just goes round and round and round. But one thing that's interesting in your article is you outline Fed Reserve Chairman Ben Bernanke's thought on this issue. He's written some things, said some things over the years prior to him becoming Fed Reserve Chairman. How do you think that affects U.S. policy moving into 2009?
Well, Ben Bernanke's contribution to the academic debate, if you will, came before he was chairman of the Federal Reserve. Ben Bernanke is a very well-known economist who taught at Princeton for many years. And in the middle of the decade, in 2005, he gave a lecture that became very influential because he looked at the China-U.S. problem in a different way. Rather than focusing on the trade deficit that the U.S. runs with China, he looked looked at the problem from the other side of the telescope, if you will. He said that what China, and not only China, a number of developing countries and oil exporting countries, that what they do is because they export so heavily and because they keep their currency tied to the U.S. dollar and because their own consumers don't spend as much, they rack up, they pile up these enormous hoards of cash. And he referred to this as the global savings glut, that there's in fact a glut of savings around the world. And this savings, this enormous pool of capital, has to go somewhere. They don't want to have it just sit in their own country. So what they do is they invest it in American government debt. And so he outlined the theory. It wasn't absolutely brand new when he outlined it, but he was the first person to articulate it in a way that made it sort of easily understandable. And the contention that some people have is that he also influenced policymakers. And the conclusion he drew in 2005 was there isn't a whole lot Americans can do about this in the short run, that these are imbalances that will have to work themselves out over time. So the question is whether policymakers, particularly people at the Fed and at the Treasury Department, adopted a more passive approach to China than perhaps they should have, because they were thinking, well, look, this is a market phenomenon. It's not something that we with American policy can fix overnight. Hence, we'll just let it wind itself out. And this may have sort of exacerbated the problem. We may have sort of put off the solution by saying to ourselves, gee, it's not our problem. It's actually someone else's problem, and we're merely on the receiving end of it. So that's the debate that we try to flesh out a little bit in the article.
Mark Landler, thank you for joining us this morning. Obviously, many things to consider, and there will be some decisions that will affect that relationship coming in 2009. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Mark Landler is an international economics correspondent for the New York Times, and he was coming to us from Charlottesville, Virginia.
China is responsible for that string of Treasury bill auction successes that is so important to the U.S. Treasury. We are talking about streaks today. The L.A. Lakers beat the Celtics last night to end the longest winning streak in Boston basketball history. What's your favorite streak? Here's an answer.
Hi, I'm Kevin from Weehawken, and my favorite streak is The Streak by Ray Stevens.
Well, yes, they call him The Streak.
I'm actually surprised it took this long
I for know.
To suggest that. 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org. And here's your takeaway.
Look for Southwest. Look for where they're going. Look for where they're flying, because fares inevitably go down when they enter a city.
Southwest is a sort of a bellwether of the aviation industry, which is doing well, according to senior aviation correspondent for Condé Nast Traveler, Barbara Peterson, who talked with us. And if you want to hear that segment again, we're always on. Take our podcast. Subscribe now at thetakeaway.org or on iTunes.
I'm Adore Udogian. Have a wonderful weekend.
And I'm John Hockenberry. This, of course, is The Takeaway.
Is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. The Rockefeller Foundation and its campaign for American workers. More at rockfound.org. And by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is The Takeaway.
At Radiolab, we love nothing more than nerding out about science, neuroscience, chemistry.
But we do also like to get into other kinds of stories. Stories about policing or
politics,
country music,
hockey,
sex of bugs.
Regardless of whether we're looking at science or not science, we bring a rigorous curiosity to get you the answers.
And hopefully make you see the world anew.
Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know.
Wherever you get your podcasts.